When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
This is the Last Word FM podcast, powered by Transmission Roundhouse. In this episode, Yahya Clark speaks with writer and journalist Anifiok Ekpodom. In January 2024, Anifiok released his debut book, Where We Come From, Rap, Home and Hope in Modern Britain. He speaks to Yahya about documenting social history and what that means to him. Here's Yahya in conversation with Anifiok.
Hi everyone, to those here at the Roundhouse and at home or on your commutes listening in, welcome back to The Last Word FM. I really hope you've been enjoying the programme today. So I'm Yahya Azriah Clark, I'm a writer, researcher and cultural producer from South London, and today I'm joined by Anifiok Ekpodom, also known as Neef, ahead of his series of conversations next week here as a part of the festival. So Neef is a journalist, researcher, documentarian, writing for the likes of Vice, Noisy, British GQ, and The Guardian. And as of this year, an author with his debut book, Where We Come From, Rap, Home, and Hope in Modern Britain. Before we get into it, there's something I really want to say about the book, actually. Since its release in January, the book has given us boundless insight into how black music underground genres from the 80s to early noughties have influenced rap and given it its mainstream status of today. But also, this book is a treasure trove that looks into the history of black and working class communities in the UK, from like London to Birmingham, and also often skirted over South Wales. So big up the book for that. Like, that is really a huge part of the book that can't be missed. And also, I don't want to skirt over also, Neef is also from South London. I cannot miss an opportunity to hail up the best part of London, so we're going to do that. So I wanted to start by talking about you. So locales are a huge thing throughout the book. We learn about communities down to the street, specific centres, businesses, many of which don't exist anymore. But for you, I wanted to ask, where specifically are you from in South London, and how has that sort of locale shaped your love for rap?
Got you. Well, first, thank you for having me. Yeah. Thank you for that introduction as well. Very, very flattering. And thank you for reading the book as well. In terms of, yeah, locales are such a big part of the book and then just my work in general. So I'm from Bromley, which is, I feel like that's on like the very edges of South East London, essentially. Yeah. And I feel like growing up there, having moved there from Lewisham anyway, I feel like it exposed me to like what both parts of the city are like in terms of more inner the city and then out of the city, even just like the region and the texture of the regions and that kind of thing. But then also I feel like you're kind of like in a middle ground where you're kind of like on the outside looking in towards London, but then you're on the outside looking out towards Kent. So you're never really part of either. And I feel like that kind of outsider perspective, I think, helped when, in terms of you see how the book is written, in terms of being able to travel through all of these different places, I think that like curiosity comes from seeing and being parts of so many of these different communities that layer over each other in London and elsewhere.
It's kind of how you described Croydon in the book, actually.
When you
were speaking about Cadet and Gypset. So it's really interesting that you say that, actually, because that sense of outside looking in, I've never thought of it like that. just based on like where your zone is in London, your how it helps you to find a proximity to these other places that are outside of London. It's really interesting. Also throughout the book, there are a lot of eureka moments. I feel like there's always this spiritual pull that someone's getting into the genres. It's never just sort of, people are not necessarily bringing them into, it's like a spiritual pull that's happening. I'm wondering for you, like you've been writing for years, working on video essays, documentaries and stuff like that. What made you go, this needs to be a book now?
I think because of that, because of some of those moments, I think with the book, I always knew I wanted to write and I always knew I wanted to write books. But there was something in being able to see, especially with the work I was doing freelancing for like Vice and Guardian. Mm-hmm. I was working at a place called SBTV at the time as well. And we were getting to travel across the country and go to these different places, go to Birmingham to spend time with musicians, go to Manchester to spend time with musicians. And I remember always thinking I could see how the music was impacting people's, not just their own lives, but their own local communities as well. And I was like, this is something that's clearly happening outside of London as well. It's not just a specific story that's happening here. There's like a connected national story that I would love to tell. And that is like kind of the origins of the book in that sense. And then I think the eureka moments came because as much as like being interested in documenting the music, I really wanted to document people's like internal and interior lives in that way and showcase, I guess, like the humanity that sits under the music. So instead of it being like a biography of UK rap from set date to here, I wanted to show you the lives of the people who have shaped the history of the genre and have been shaped by the genres as well. And I think by doing that process of really sitting with people and interviewing people and spending years with people, you, I guess, learn that music is almost just a vessel for all of the things that everybody's looking for in our own lives, like connection, sense of connection, sense of community, love, family, all of these things. And through going on that journey, there are like those spiritual moments that I guess knit people's lives together in that way. They're usually kept personally for ourselves, but I guess in the book, it was an opportunity to showcase what those look like for some of the people all across the country.
I find it really interesting that you mentioned community, because one thing that jumped out to me in the book actually was your way of introducing some of the biggest grime and rap stars. Like, so if anyone here hasn't read the book, Neef doesn't do this thing of like, oh, and this is like, he doesn't go, oh, so this huge rap star and like introduce something like that. It's more, it's a very slow burner. Usually starts with their community and then delves slowly and then reveals in maybe like the last few paragraphs of the chapter who this person is by way of their stage name. Find it really interesting. Cadet was a huge example for that. You spoke about his family, the Johnsons. In terms of uncovering this sort of information, like what was that like? What was that process like?
Yeah, it was very. It was rewarding. So much went into that, and so many emotions even come back when I'm thinking about it. Especially with someone like Cadet, who's obviously passing before I'd even started writing the book. But I think the reason why I did that in terms of that slow burn and showcasing the community before the artist, because I was really interested and really keen to show that, like genres like UK rap, grime, drill, all of these genres, they haven't just exploded out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And although there are like really popular musicians like Krebs and Cone and Stormzy, Dave, Lil Sims, that they aren't accidents. Like there's a lot that happened before for artists like those to emerge. And so I was always really keen to showcase like the communities that sit at the bedrock of the musicians and of the music. And then when I was really then trying to dial in to tell like specific stories, like with Cadet, I was like, okay, this starts before he arrived here, essentially, and starts in Clapham with his grandparents coming to Clapham and his parents being born in South London. And that story, that was the story for me. And then looking at what was the texture of the land and the music that he inherited. And it was okay, like garage was really big at the time. So Solid were huge in and around Battersea and those areas. So it was about trying to tell that story to show you organically how somebody like he emerges, and then also to show that he's a product of it, but then also like a link in a chain almost, and it's going to influence what comes after him too.
So one thing I want to ask is, in terms of putting all of that together, so what are you listening to when you're writing? Are you listening to anything when you're writing, and what is it?
Yeah, I don't listen whilst writing, but I listen before I write. Or if I'm in like a writing headspace, especially when I was writing this, I'd listen like if I'm on the way home, I'd listen. if in the morning I'd listen to certain songs just to get me in the mood. One song I listened to a lot was Blood Orange, High Street featuring Skepta. Mm. And I think that song, I think, perfectly kind of encapsulated what I was trying to do, because the Skepta verses are about, I guess, like Tottenham High Road, essentially.
Yeah.
But he really pulls you into, like, what is physically going on in there, like what's emotionally going on in the lives of the people who are living there. Yeah. And what can he see? So as much as it's musical, it's also centered in like that sense of the personal as well, and that in that sense of the communal, and that really captured like what I was trying to do in words, essentially. So I'd listen to that song a lot, and other songs like that I'd have on a playlist which I just shuffle through. So there was a lot of like Kano on there. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of music just with a lot of emotion in it as well. That was a really big thing for me. So even like a lot of early Georgia Smith, I'd listen mm-hmm. to a lot of that music that I felt like had a lot of emotion in it, and that would allow me to, like, I guess, like, be open when I'm then going to write these quite like intimate and vulnerable stories.
Were you ever listening to, so say, like, when you were traveling, because I know you say that South Wales was the place that you were the least familiar with in terms of the history, and the lineage. And I even have family from South Wales. That's where my family first came. Yeah, Cardiff Bay.
Oh, no way.
Tiger Bay, formerly Bay. And I still don't know much about it. So, like, in terms of music and preparing yourself, like, what were you doing in that regard for areas like South Wales?
Yeah, no, listening to music, especially for South Wales and the West Midlands, was a big part of it, because that, I think, is the beauty of rap music, essentially. Like, I feel like rap takes you so directly and specifically into a place in a way that no other medium can. Like, the news can't do it. Maybe photography and stuff can do it, but there are few other mediums that bring you directly into the heart of a place and let you understand like what's going on there. So in South Wales, there was a guy called Luke RV who I'd listened to a lot, and he, when I was in Wales and in Cardiff, I knew a bit more about, because it's the city and it's the capital. But then when you go further out of Cardiff, there are like, they call like the valleys, which are like essentially old like industrial steel towns, and everybody in Cardiff would say like, don't go there, essentially, when I'd be talking about it. But then I found this musician Luke who was from there, and when you listen to his music, you immediately get a sense of like what that place is like, the sense of loss, the sense of kind of like mundanity as well, when you're in a huge place with not many travel connections, that kind of thing. So hearing those kind of songs would really bring me into like the mood of a place, especially before I met the musicians. I think that was a really, really big help. And then I did the same in the West Midlands with, especially in Coventry, with like a lot of that section centres on Parsaloo. So I listened to a lot of his music, but then I listened to a lot of the music that was coming before him in that area. So there's a group called The Specials who are like from the 70s, who are like iconic British two-tone band. I listened to them, and I listened to Grime. And then I listened to also just to hear like what are the familiarities and similarities between these genres that have passed through the same region, even though they have different titles. And you'd start to hear certain things like the accents that people use, or some of the like the local references that I wouldn't have been able to pick up unless you're from that area, some of the slang that people use. So that was like quite interesting too, because I wanted to try and bleed some of that stuff into the actual like literature as well.
Yeah. In terms of, because also when you were doing your research, because you're speaking about like how different things have passed through the areas, what you sort of addressed in the book was this sense that even generations that operate now may not have known what was going on in their own areas two generations before. How did you sort of reckon with that during your research process, and in terms, how did it influence how you sort of translated it in the book, that generational gap?
Yeah, no, that was such a big thing, because we were talking before about even like the context setting that I put in the beginning of the book. So the beginning starts with the Windrush generation in the West Midlands, then in South London, then in Cardiff, it goes back to Tiger Bay and the early 1900s. And a lot of people I didn't know that history, especially in like Tiger Bay. I didn't know there were black communities in the UK for over 100 years. And so I think it was important to have those parts in, because I started to realise when I then start to talk to younger people, they were completely unaware of like the history that was permeating their own area, essentially. And so at the beginning, I was like, I don't want to write a book that where I'm having to explain what blackness is to anyone. I don't want to do that. Like, if you open it, you can understand it. But then as I got further into actually interviewing black people, I was like, oh, like, there's a lot of us that don't actually know what happened 60 years ago, 70 years ago. And even if people may know like the terms for things like Windrush generation, these things, don't actually know like the specific experiences that happened to people and how that directly links to like people's lives today and the music today. So then I realized, if I was going to tell a story about, UK rap, essentially, that story has to expand further out than just UK rap itself. It has to expand all the way back to, I guess, the origins of black people in these different spaces across the UK.
Yeah, one thing I found really interesting as well is how you speak about the travel and the movement of music in that intro, the travel and the movement of music, even just throughout the African diaspora at large. Mm. But one thing that I really loved, it's quite bold, was when you said hip-hop born of sound system culture. Now, we know there are a lot of arguments around it, disco coming from like groups such as The Last Poets, Gil Scott Heron, but one thing I really liked is after you made that statement, you'd also bring it back. You sort of talk about how things have fed genres and sort of sent it back. Mm. When you were thinking about sort of where these things stem from, what sort of resources and stuff did you call on? Obviously, I know you know a lot about music, but in terms of historical account and archives, what were you sort of calling on when making these references?
Yeah, that was like a really interesting part of the research process. And as you say, like even talking about hip hop, one thing I realized is that because of how dominant like hip hop is as a genre and has been over the last 50 years, we almost always tend to think of it as like a starting point. And then, but when you like do some research, you realize that's clear, that's not the case. So even like the idea that there's stuff that's born, that birthed hip hop that isn't just American, so to speak, or isn't just centered in like black American communities, but goes outwards. To some people, especially when I talk about that, was like a difficult idea. But then when you zoom out, like that is like the nature of like black music in the diaspora. It's like constantly pushing and pulling between all of these different places. So to research that, a lot of it was YouTube was like such a big resource, essentially. There are like so many like, I guess like ripped documentaries that exist all across YouTube, and a lot of like archive as well that is ripped from, I guess like you can find news channels from like the 60s, the 50s, where they've just ripped the archive and they may be talking about a specific black community in America, in the UK, in Jamaica. And you're hearing people actually speak directly what's happening at the time period and how they're feeling, which was a really interesting tool to be able to use, because I found that like academic textbooks and stuff didn't necessarily have the history that was there. And then I guess the biggest thing was the interviews. Like going to actually interview a lot of these people was probably the biggest process and part of the book. So it was 5 years of interviewing people up and down the UK and speaking with elders in all of these different places, South London, Wales, Birmingham, and really trying to hear their experiences firsthand. Because you realise like a lot of the, there's a place in Birmingham, there was a radio station called PCRL Radio, People Communities Radio Link, and it started after after the first Handsworth riots. And the guy who founded it, Cecil Morris, like I was able to track him down and go and sit in his house and speak to him. And when he like told me the extent of his story, I was like, even though there are bits of this online, like this doesn't exist anywhere. Like all of these specific things you've told me about what fed into why you would make a radio station for your community actually is absent. And I think that really dawned on me that a lot of black history is oral, essentially, which is a beautiful thing in how it's passed down, but then at times can be a dangerous thing because as a generation passes away, like that history can get lost if it's not written down. And so part of the book then became an intention to try and have those stories written down and cemented in archive alongside like these more contemporary stories too.
Did that influence you in terms of like, because the accounts are so visceral, like I don't think there was any other way that I could have taken in the fact that PCRL was shut down so many times, like you were so visceral. Did that sort of influence, did you sort of have this feeling of this is like the chance to get it out? You know, did it influence how you went about it?
Yeah, partly, because I definitely felt in, because even with him, when I'd speak to everyone in Birmingham, they talk about pirate radio so much and they talk about this station so much. And so it became a point of like, especially when you're reporting, like if you hear something two or three times, that's always an indication like you need to try and follow what that is. And then I wanted to, especially the visceral quality, it was really important to not just tell the facts of the story, but then to really show you what that meant for somebody who was living through it. And I think probably that probably comes from like a lot of my inspiration is mainly fiction. So I read mainly fiction. Because I think that is such a beautiful way of like looking at someone's interior life and emotions and details and really pulling that onto page. So I think a lot of that came from that influence where, yeah, that is probably what I draw from the most when writing, is trying to blend that. It's called narrative nonfiction, essentially, when you try and blend like fictional techniques with nonfiction actual subject matters.
Do you read Toni Morrison?
Yeah, I just finished.
I can tell.
I just read *Beloved* by which is like probably the best novel I've read, I would say.
I recommend *Sula*.
Okay.
And *Song of Solomon*.
Okay.
Very,
yeah,
very, very good books. But I was like, I can tell you've read a bit of Toni because very visceral quality.
Praise, thank you.
So, as much of the history is oral, like, what did you do when you met Gaps? Mm. Because you were saying how. I listened to an interview and you were saying how, like in South Wales, for example, you had to go off a lot of the accounts that Phil was giving. Mm. So how did you sort of reckon with Gaps? And when it came to this process of like having to be accountable to the reader, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, that was interesting in that, say in South London, especially talking about on the more contemporary side anyway, I feel like I knew so much of the history because I was there. I was like, started listening to it like 11 up until when I was writing the book. So I felt like there was so much knowledge I had, even from just, like going to like house parties growing up, knowing what music is resonating in certain spaces. Whereas like then going to Wales was completely out of my like wheelhouse. It was that completely out of like my field of knowledge. So it's like having to like learn a whole new area, but wanting to do it at the same depth that I did the South London section with.
Yeah.
So one thing I actually did was I'd then interview like university lecturers because that, like sociology lecturers, that was a really big thing because they were able to like just download like what is the history of the region in the way that I just couldn't necessarily find myself. So when I wrote a chapter, the chapter's about the formation of like the areas, working class areas in South and East Cardiff and the formation of like the South Wales Valleys and the working class communities there, those were from conversations with like a university lecturer, and she was basically telling me like what happened in Wales and what has defined like modern era Wales, and talking about I guess like their deindustrialization process, them trying to get a sense of independence from England, and how like that sense of revolution permeated into other areas of Cardiff, but the working class areas were essentially not funded in the same way, and that's why you had all of these huge estates across the across that region that were neglected essentially. And hearing those accounts was like, I just couldn't have found that just by myself. Mm-hmm. So that was like a big thing I would do, is try to go like direct to sources. And then from there, she'd be able to, the lecturers would be able to say like, go and read this text. This text is really important. Go and read this text. Go and read this text. And there was like kind of a jump off point to be able to do that. So that was like more on the historical side. And then on like the, with dealing with the artists themselves, it's interesting because Phil, who's like the lead person in the South Wales story, he was in a band called Asteroid Boys, and they were like a grime, but they mixed like other elements of music that was popular in Wales at the time. But I guess the interesting thing is obviously with a band, everyone has different accounts of like the truth. So you kind of just learn, and especially as they like got really big and then they broke up and they had like quite a sour breakup. So everybody has very different accounts of what happened. So I think part of it was knowing that sometimes there is no one truth. Like you just have to accept that there are multiple accounts of what happened and try and present them, and kind of leave it for people to decide which they take as truth in that sense. Because I think, especially with any kind of art, you don't want to be overly definitive, because there isn't overly one, like one answer or one correct answer in that sense. So that was just about presenting what I'd seen and what I'd heard, and then just letting it, I guess, sit with people.
Okay, so like after doing all this research and writing, like I've seen a lot of the events that you've done over the past 6 months, like you've really been out there like breathing life into this book and sort of making sure, seeing the people and seeing how it's resonating with them. I know you recently done, what was it, RAP party? And I saw on Instagram you spoke about how like that being in that space particularly touched you. Like how do you plan to like engage with the history in your book going forward? I know you've done a lot of it already, but for somewhere like South Wales, for example, how would you imagine doing that?
Yeah, definitely want to continue taking the book to these places. And I think often as well with books, because like books exist in such a specific space, so it's like trying to break out of that, like essentially like very like white middle class literature industry, and trying to bring other people into that space, which is something I've been really conscious of trying to do. And that's, I think, probably the thing I'm probably proudest of, about at this moment in terms of events is being able to do that. So I had a lot of people come to the event and say, I've never been to like a book event before, like this is my first. But that is like, I'm really proud of that to show, because like, I really want the people whose histories I'm telling in the book to actually be able to engage with the book in that sense. So Wales, I definitely have a lot of plans to go into the musical scenes, but then also just kind of go to some of the community centres and youth centres around there and share the book with people that way, because I think sometimes like it's just about going direct to source in that sense. And then I think going forward, like obviously even next week, of course, got like the last words events that I'm doing. And I think what's exciting now that the book has been out for a bit is like engaging with different elements of the book. So like the first event is like with Bashy, and that's like a in-depth in conversation essentially. And that I think now having the book be now, I have the freedom to be able to lift specific elements of the book. So what does hope mean in the context of rap music? What does hope mean in the context of Britain? What does hope mean in the context of London? And then talk with an artist who I feel his work and music influenced the book massively, like his writing influenced the book massively. Before I was a reader, I was listening to rap music. That's like where my love of literature came from, and he was like one of those musicians. So to be able to hold that kind of conversation, I think will be quite special. And also to show that like these things don't exist in like brackets that are solely apart. Like rap isn't separate from nonfiction, or isn't separate from poetry, or isn't separate from fiction. These things all exist together and all feed each other in some way. So that's kind of what I'm really keen to do going forward, I would say.
So it seems like you're really at a point where you're engaging in, especially like the social history aspect of it. Because a lot of the talks that you're doing and a lot of the events have been like, overarching and broad and welcoming the community in.
Yeah.
But one thing I also noticed about your work and the way you approach it is you are consistently sharing like old videos that show a makeup or the fabric of what Black Britain or just working class Britain at large. Like, how do you know, I know it sounds like a weird question, but how do you know what to put out there immediately and what to say for like research that will go into something later?
I definitely get that, because I think a lot of the stuff, so on Instagram I share like just a lot of old archive or old photography collections and that kind of thing. I think one I shared last week was from a documentary about like Black British identity in the 70s, and it was like the first generation of Caribbean people born here, and they were talking about whether they feel British or not. And there was a young woman who was saying she, like, Britain has nothing for her, she doesn't feel British and can't feel British. And I thought that was so interesting in terms of where things are at now with the term Black British, and like how a lot of people do feel comfortable using that term now. And it's interesting like looking at what's happened over the space of 40 years to allow that to happen. But in terms of then what I share, a lot of those things I share, those are things that I watched when researching the book, and there were like a lot of the themes and ideals that hovered over the book. So now the book is out, I'm just like, I can share them all freely now about thinking I'm letting too much go, or I'm letting like kind of air out of the book, if that makes sense. So yeah, I'm just going to be sharing. I've got long YouTube playlists of like 300 videos. So until that's done, expect my Instagram to be populated with them.
Another thing I wanted to ask is because you're obviously consistently writing profiles and interviews and stuff while you're writing the book, how did you differentiate? I know you had your locales pinned down, but how did you sort of differentiate between, you know, for the writers out there that may be juggling a long form project with more consistent like freelance writing, how did you juggle that? Did they feed into each other, or what did you have to compartmentalize? Like, what did you have to do to ensure they wasn't getting too muddy?
Got you. Yeah, it was difficult actually. I stopped taking on freelance writing commissions when I really got into the book, because I found that coming from a journalism space, I was doing mainly, I still mainly write for The Guardian. And that is like a very different headspace to writing a book, because that's like a newspaper, quick turnaround for things, quick edits, and even the language you have to use. I did a profile for them once of the Adenuga family, so Skepta, Jamie, Julie, both their parents and their brother Jason. And that was a story that I knew so well, because having grown up with just them being ever present. But then you realise that's going on like the front page of The Guardian. So there's people in like Cornwall who are reading it. So you have to even write it in a specific way that things that I would take for granted, people just across Britain understand. So you do have to change like your language slightly to adapt to that. And I didn't want to do that for the book, essentially. So I was like, okay, let me just stop and put a pause on that so I can really sink into my creativity and write in the way that I want to do. So it was quite hard to compartmentalize in that sense, actually. So I was like, I just can't do it. Yeah. I'm just going to put a pause on that. And then still freelanced in other ways. Like, I do a lot of freelancing outside of writing, which was really helpful in that sense to give me the freedom to write the book. But everybody's process is different. So I think that's just what I figured out about my creative process when doing the book. And I know some people can write throughout whilst writing a book. So I think it just depends on like your style and your approach, and more so figuring that out is what I would say, like trying to test things so you find out how, because I think in the process of writing this book, I found out so much about myself as a person and as a creative person. So I think it's about trying to figure what your processes are, and then I guess honoring them and don't be ashamed of them, like stick to that if that's what works for you in that sense.
Well, your process has definitely given us a book that we can hold on to for a very long time and learn much from.
Thank you.
And it's really broken down the lineage. And one thing I wanted to ask was, you definitely speak about the lineage of these genres being cultivated, or, you know, coming from the Caribbean between the, you know, like 60s to early 2000s, and how they've sort of birthed this mainstream era of rap. But I wanted to ask, like, there's a new wave of jungle up and running now. There are a lot of these genres, like, there's, like, a new wave of jungle and a lot of these genres coming back to the surface. How do you feel like that's going to be interwoven into rap now? Because I know it is a very distinctive scene right now, but it's getting a lot bigger. And how do you feel like that's going to be interwoven?
Yeah, it's interesting seeing like what's happening now. Whereas I think before, there always just seemed to be one dominant, although there were other genres, it used to be seemed to be like one dominant genre.
About so time, even
yeah, like you go back to jungle, then to garage, stuff like drum and bass, then grime, then UK rap, whereas now it's like everything everywhere all at once, essentially, which I think is a really beautiful thing. And I think interplay allows for like a lot more like collaboration, because when I think of like a lot of those musicians from those genres I just mentioned, there wasn't as much interplay between different sounds within the UK. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think today, like, you see a lot more collaboration across sounds, and people being less restricted to like whatever genre barrier they are, and I guess are less likely to put themselves in boxes as well. So I think that is like, I think what we're going to see a lot more of. I don't think people even have a word for like what we call this time period now. I think it's just kind of ongoing. So I think like that's really exciting. And I think also starting to notice people, because there's now such a rich tapestry of British music, that people are then, there's even like the sample choices and the influences are coming from older Black British music now, as opposed to before, I guess people would have to go back to Jamaica or go to the US to use that as like the bedrock for the sound that they're creating. Whereas now I feel like you're seeing a lot of people borrowing from what's happened only 20, 30 years ago here, and then bringing that into a contemporary sense, which I think is really exciting. And I think we'll kind of write another chapter of Black British musical history in that sense.
Any particular samples you love?
Oh, there's this artist I've been... He's like a producer, I think, but his name's like Bex Blue.
Okay.
He's been doing like the reframing a lot of the old like Risky Rhodes freestyles.
Ah, okay.
But then underplaying them with like jazz samples and that kind of thing. And it was really interesting to see how versatile like British MCs are, and how like something that you just had absorbed in one context actually still works like rhythmically and flow-wise in completely different soundscapes. So I've been listening to that a lot. Yeah, partly for nostalgia, but yeah.
Cool. So with all of that, I want to ask, like, what is the future of British rap for you? And I know you did suggest a song, I don't think we can play it, but what was the song again that you suggested that represented, like, what the future is for you again?
What was the song? I actually can't remember.
I can't remember it either. But there was a specific song that you said represented the future for you.
It was 44C. Yeah,
okay.
So he's an artist from Liverpool. And that was interesting because when you listen to that song, he's like a young kid from Liverpool and his accent is so strong on that song and in all of his music. And I think that is an indication of what's to come in terms of like how regional the spread is now.
Yeah.
You're having like people really just taking rap and putting their own specific identity and stamp on it in a way that I guess people were not doing maybe 20 years ago when London was like the centre and the fulcrum of things. So I feel like that is quite an interesting history, because even the music sounds so different, and even like the cadences and pockets that different regions are able to hit sounds very different to like what a London rapper sounds like or what a Birmingham rapper sounds like. I think that's like quite exciting because I think it opens up like completely new lanes and ways of people even being able to rap like in this country. So I'm excited about hearing like those stories, but also like what that sounds like musically too.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me, Neef. It's been wonderful getting to speak to you about the book. Thank you so much for speaking with me, and thank you all for listening.
If you want to learn more about Anif Yok's work, you can visit his website at anifyokekpodum.com. Yaya is producing a podcast for Transmission Roundhouse. The Last Word FM is powered by Transmission Roundhouse and part of the Last Word Festival program at the Roundhouse.